Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Network on Sunday, April 22nd, 2018. This is episode 1482. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Carbonite. From customer data to disaster recovery and backup, automatically protect everything in the cloud with Carbonite. To learn more, visit Carbonite.com. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. And by LastPass. Join the over 13 million LastPass users like me and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/Twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography and smartphones and smartwatches. Lots to talk about today. Lots to talk about. I'm not going to open the phone lines, though, because I am on vacation, but we do have a brand new show for you recorded ahead of time. I'm recording this just a few days before the show, just so that we'd have brand new material. Next week, Rich DeMuro will sit in live, and he's from KTLA. He's their tech guy. He's going to do a great job. He's done this before. He'll fill in for me, and I'll be back May 7th taking your calls once again. So I won't give out the phone number. I will give out the website, because everything you hear today and on all of our shows is fully explicated at techguylabs.com. You don't have to write anything down. You don't have to remember anything. Just remember that one thing, techguylabs.com. You can go there and get audio and video from previous shows, answers to questions, and all of that. So we've been following over the last few weeks a number of sad stories. Of course, the self-driving Uber that clobbered a pedestrian in Arizona and sad to say, killed her. The Tesla that killed its driver a couple of weeks ago because he was using autopilot, and autopilot didn't know better than to steer him into a highway divider. And I'm starting to see, you know, I saw something a little scary, which is that the California DMV just gave a permit to Google's self-driving car, the Waymo, which is a great name, is Waymo better than Uber, W-A-Y-M-O, to do trials of their self-driving cars without a safety driver. And they'll start in Mountain View. And if you're in Mountain View, I'd be very careful crossing the street in the future. So let me talk a little bit about that. Self-driving vehicles, the idea is that you've got additional cameras, usually something called LiDAR, which does a 3D map of the world around the car. Numerous cameras, all attached to a computer. I don't want to use the AI word, the artificial intelligence word, but the computer is fast and smart and is highly trained in to understanding what it's seeing and responding. And actually, Waymo has a really good video on YouTube, which you could watch if you're curious, what the car is seeing and how it's responding, that shows that one of the things Waymo does is it slows down when it gets to an ambiguous situation. It slows down a lot. Really, it may even come to a complete halt when it can't figure out what's going on. That's appropriate, right? Don't just, you know, humans don't do that. In fact, this is one of the reasons, I think there's a number of reasons why people are interested in self-driving vehicles. The best reason is humans are terrible drivers. Last year, I think 6,000 deaths attributed to distracted driving, people texting or fiddling with the radio or putting on their makeup while they're driving. That's a lot. Those accidents would probably be 100% eliminated had they been in self-driving vehicles. But there are some problems too. And as we're testing self-driving vehicles, most of these vehicles have what they call safety drivers, humans behind the wheel, actual controls and humans behind the wheel. They're not driving, but in case something goes wrong, they disengage the automatic features and take over. We've seen numbers now from Waymo and Uber and others. They call them their disengagement numbers. And they're required to do a report. There is quite a difference, however, between Uber's disengagement numbers and Google's disengagement numbers. After the pedestrian was killed in Tempe a couple of weeks ago, we learned that Uber actually can't go or hasn't been able to go more than 13 miles on average without the safety driver taking over. 13 miles. Waymo, same thing, 5,600 miles between disengagements. That's a lot more. Now, I should still point out that that means every 13 miles when a Uber's driving along, somebody has to say, whoops, you're doing the wrong thing. And even though Waymo's much better at 5,600 miles, when you're driving hundreds of thousands of miles a year, that's still a lot of disengagements. It's not, in other words, every disengagement is an admission that the computer is not perfect, that it's either doing something wrong, about to do something wrong, is confused, that the human says, I better take over here. And so it's important to understand that we are in the early days of this. And it's unfortunate that, you know, Tesla's getting some heat right now. I have a Tesla Model X with the autopilot feature. You spend a lot for that, $5,000. For what Tesla calls autopilot, I would call lane keeping and advanced cruise control. That's not autopilot. Autopilot implies that the car flies itself. It doesn't. In fact, Tesla, in that fatal accident, said, well, sure, he was an autopilot, but we'd warned him 6 seconds earlier he should have his hands on the wheel. Well, I got to tell you, as somebody who uses autopilot, you have to keep your hands on the wheel all the time, or the autopilot, regardless of what's going on, will say, come on, keep your hands on the wheel, keep your hands on the wheel. So that just shows you it is an autopilot. Tesla wants you to watch. And I have disengaged many times. I don't know what my rate is, but I'm sure Tesla does because they keep track of all this stuff. It isn't perfect. Tesla has done us a little bit of a disservice calling it autopilot, because it isn't. It's fancy cruise control. It's a great tragedy that this engineer, he was an Apple engineer, young guy, 38, family, had reported to Tesla, you know, every time I go around this curve, the autopilot wants to plow me into the rail. Even having told Tesla that, according to his family, he decided to continue to use the autopilot. And apparently wasn't really paying attention when the car ran into the... Well, we know it wasn't, because he would have had time to avoid it had he been paying attention. Tesla says his hand wasn't on the wheel. Tesla doesn't know. I got to tell you this from my own experience. I have my hands on the wheel. I don't take it off. I have a death grip when I'm using the autopilot because I'm really paying attention. And it still will say, put your hands on the wheel. And so the only way you can get it to say, okay, is by slightly jerking the wheel. It is not some magical sensor in there. It's not automatically sensing the sweaty palms of the driver on the wheel. It's looking for you to kind of move the wheel a little bit. So Tesla may say, oh, he didn't have his hands on the wheel. That's not clear, in my opinion. That's not at all clear. He could have had his hands on the wheel. If you buy one of these cars, don't buy it because it drives itself. We're not even close. Even with Waymo, which is the best, once every 5,600 miles, a human has to take over. And this is a little scary because Waymo, as I said, just got a permit in California to send out its cars, self-driving vehicles, without a human. Without a human. So what is going to happen during those moments where disengagement should happen? Some of these guys, I think Waymo is one of them, actually want to make vehicles that don't have pedals, don't have steering wheels. It's a living room on wheels. You let the car drive. Look, this will save lives. Self-driving vehicles will save lives. The other reason, it saves money. Uber needs it because, frankly, they're losing their shirts by paying drivers. If they could get rid of drivers, Uber might make sense financially. They need it to make sense financially. There's lots of reasons why you might want self-driving cars. It changes the whole notion of ownership. If cars can navigate to you, you don't need to own a car because, frankly, car ownership's wasteful. How many hours a day does your car spend being driven? How many hours a day does it spend just sitting there? Right? Maybe a couple hours a day driving, 20 hours a day just sitting there. Well, if you didn't have to own that car, if that could just come to you when you need it and you'd leave it out where when you're done, that would eliminate private ownership and save a lot of resources, save a lot of money for all of us. So there's lots of good reasons. The number one reason in my mind is safety. Humans are terrible drivers, but just not yet. The cars are just not better yet. What do you think? All right, we're going to go. I use my autopilot, but I don't treat it as autopilot. I really don't. Let's go to the phones. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Your call's next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to go to the phones. Let's see what we've got here. Line three, Roger in Florida. Hi, Roger.
Hello, Leo.
Hello,
Roger. Thank you very much for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
I apologize for what I'm sure is going to sound like an overly techie question, but I would be willing to bet there's a lot of other people that have the same problem and don't even know it.
Well, I handle the whole range. So let's just do it all. I'll try to, if you say something too geeky, I'll try to define it. What is it that's going on?
Okay, I am a cord cutter, and for my local television, I put up a nice big antenna with an amplifier. I have multiple Silicon Dust HD home run tuners hooked up to a server running Myst TV for my
very nice
stuff.
That's a very nice setup. So that means you don't pay a cable company for television. You use the internet and your antenna for TV.
That's correct.
That's cord cutting, and I like it. Yeah.
The problem is we are just at the fringe of where our local area reception can come in. And like I said, I've already got a big antenna and an amplifier. But every once in a while, when conditions are not good, the signal drops out. Well, we also subscribe to DirecTV Now. And I keep getting emails from them telling me about the various local channels that are available on DirecTV Now.
Yeah.
And one day when the signal went out, I said, well, let me just switch over.
And there it is.
Lo and behold, there's no network television.
What?
So, no.
So it depends on your locale, and that's the issue. Where in Florida are you?
We're just outside of Tampa.
Okay. So I use YouTube TV, similar to DirecTV Now, and they have locals in the San Francisco area, but whether they'd have them in your area, it depends on, frankly, the locals in Tampa and whether they allow it.
They do have them. That's not the problem. What happens is my DSL line, according to the geolocation on the DSL line, I'm in a city 75 miles away. So my billing address and my physical location don't match, so I don't get the local.
That stinks.
I spent hours. I mean, hours.
Oh, that's an interesting problem. So this is terrible. And really, AT&T should know better than this, because it's very common that your actual location differs from your IP address's geolocation. IP address geolocation, everybody knows, is far from perfect. It's a best guess. I've talked before, there's a city in Kansas, actually a house in the middle of a cornfield in Kansas, that is the geographical center of the United States. And when the IP address geolocators can't figure out where an IP address is, they just know it's somewhere in the United States, they place it at this house in the middle of a cornfield in Kansas. They drop a pin there. And the poor people who live there are constantly harassed by people who say, well, my phone said that you're the person who robbed me on eBay, or you're the person who stole my iPhone. This is what it says. Yeah, because we're the default. We're not where it is. It's just geolocation with IP addresses is imperfect. So, you know, I would guess that any sophisticated company like AT&T would know that. The fact that you need to escalate it to a higher authority.
Oh, I have.
And they still say, well, no, you can't possibly be living there. Your IP address says you're in Biloxi.
They had me try it with my DSL line. They had me try
No, you can't change it. It's not your fault. It's their fault. They're using a geolocation service that says your IP address is somewhere it's not. That's not your fault.
The only thing that would work is if I wanted to connect with my telephone through the cellular data, which, first of all, I don't have TV on my phone, and second of all, I have very limited data on my...
Do me a favor. They've got a free month trial on YouTube TV. See if they have the same problem. I bet you Google's a little bit smarter about this than AT&T.
But I thought there had to be some way to get around this geolocation.
No, because it's not something you're doing. It's this more... No, but see, it's not your fault. It's the same... These people in Kansas, they don't... There's nothing they can do about it. There's a guy left a toilet in their driveway. He was so angry at them. They have nothing to do with it. It's because they use services... Like, you know, IP location services, AT&T's using one that match your IP address to your location, but it doesn't match because it isn't your location. And they just say, well, that's what it says. That's what this is the answer. That's what the computer said. Must be true. They don't care. In fact, frankly, they would love you to use your cell service for your television. Do you have AT&T cell service?
No, I have Verizon on my cell phone, but I have AT&T hotspot. They had me try that. That shows me being in Texas.
Right. Because IP addresses are not a good way to locate somebody. They were just it's not a GPS locale. It's a very rough indicator, and the fact that they're using that shows their ignorance. So you might try, and I mean you could go to your internet service provider and say, hey, is there any way you could give me a new IP address that's closer to my location? That's not likely to work.
Well, we've had the same DSL line for several years, and as you know, occasionally it will change, and it always resolves to the same city.
Yeah,
which
because
is about 75 miles away from you.
Yeah, because the internet service provider has a pool of IP addresses, and they're all associated with its corporate headquarters. That's why anybody with any brains doesn't use IP geolocation to figure out where somebody is. It's a known problem. You aren't where you don't live where your ISP's business address is.
Mm-hmm.
Why should they use that to identify you? That's so frustrating.
Well, all they have to do is get on APRS, and they look for K4RS, and they will see where I'm at.
I know. So you're a ham, I take it.
Oh, yes, sir.
Oh, yes, sir. Well,
I just had to throw that in.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. What's your say your call sign again?
Ham. Kilo 4 Romeo Sierra.
Now, does this count as a QSL if I talk to you on the phone? I don't think so.
I don't think so. I am on a cordless telephone.
Oh, well, you're transmitting. All right.
But we're not operating in the ham.
I would just as an experiment try PlayStation View, Sling TV, YouTube TV. All of them offer free trials. And just see if your locals work with them.
I'm sure that they probably would, or there's a possibility. I just really don't want to switch because I was one of those suckers.
Oh.
Signed up when DirecTV came out and got their
you got a deal
for a little price, and I don't want to do away with that plan.
I don't know of any way other than complaining and trying and escalating to somebody who has a little more brains. I understand what they look. Think about the call service person. All their computer says no. You're not there. You're here. No, I'm not. My internet service provider there. Well, I don't know. It just says this is what the computer says. Computers don't lie. It must be. And how are you going to get around that? Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Thank you, Leo.
I am sorry that there's no good answer for that. People keep saying use a VPN, but you don't want to use a VPN for streaming.
You knew.
Yeah. No, I mean, you could perhaps if you set up a VPN. No, how would that work? You couldn't even do that. Mike B. said, use a VPN. You'd have to find a VPN service that was in your, neighborhood.
I actually do use a VPN for a lot of the things that you discuss, and the closest node is in Miami.
Yeah, that's the problem. You want something that will show up, identify to these morons at AT&T. This is a really interesting, surprisingly kind of intractable issue. That's very interesting. They're being jerks. They're
their reasoning, but I would
no. There's no reasoning. No, they're using something inappropriately. They're using IP geolocation inappropriately. That's all there is to it. They're acting as if it's accurate. It's not. It never has been.
I'm glad I don't live in Kansas.
Your billing address is in your home, right?
Yes.
They won't accept that? That's because they're jerky jerks.
Well, they've got my service address. And
they know where you live.
Right, zip code,
yes. No, I could see here your IP address says you live at your internet service provider's business address. It says it right here.
What? Jerky jerks. That's jerky jerks.
But because the two don't match, and there's no way they've got of updating their database.
Well, they just, you know, they just really have to. I mean, this is stupidity. I was talking yesterday. I have this slide rule about how people should put the slide rule back in the classroom because it teaches you about data accuracy. You know, when you're using a calculator, you think you're accurate to 20 decimal points, but you're not. They're acting as if IP addresses are accurate. They're not. This is just what we call innumeracy, illiteracy with numbers. They're innumerate. Sorry. I'm telling you, somebody, I bet you Google does it right. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo the phone number. And let's see here. Line 2, Jack in Maine. Hello, Jack in Maine.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
Great. How are you doing? Thanks for hanging on.
Yeah, I'm originally from Southern California, so I've listened to you ages ago, and I remember back in the Atari 1040 ST days reading your article.
Oh, my gosh. Nobody remembers that.
You've always given great advice.
That was the 70s, dude. Now you're dating us both. Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great.
That's why I'm calling you now.
Okay.
So I'm in the banking industry, and I worked for a company for a long time, and I recently resigned. And I have an Apple iPhone 7S Plus, and it's because client data was carried over the phone, they had my Apple ID be my email address.
Uh-oh.
At that company.
Uh-oh.
And it was an encrypted phone, so like 20 minutes after I resigned,
no.
They wiped it clean, you know, as far as contacts and emails and stuff, which is fine, but now I have to change it over to my personal Apple ID, and I'm wondering, A, is that difficult, and B, when I switch it over, am I going to lose the apps I paid for? Am I going to lose the songs I paid for on iTunes? Am I going to lose Music Match? I mean, what am I up against?
You can change the email address associated with that old Apple ID. Is the company asserting that that's their ID? I mean, I understand that the email address was a corporate email address, but they're not saying that that account is their account, or are they?
No, they're not being difficult about that.
So what you want to do is go to the Apple ID webpage and say, I want to change my email associated with that ID. Now, the only issue there is they're going to send an email asking if that's okay to the old address.
Yeah, which I can't do.
And you don't have any access to that.
Right.
You might try it anyway. I'm pretty sure that... See, the whole thing, all of this is designed to keep somebody from stealing your phone and then reactivating it on their account.
Right.
For instance, you need to... in order to use that phone, you need to take it off of the old account. You need to actually log into the old account and turn off Find My iPhone and then erase the phone while logged in order to reuse that phone. Otherwise, it's going to say, okay, but you got to log in to your iCloud. And
so I should back it up before that.
Yeah, well, definitely back it up. I think at this point, though, a call to Apple is in order. And I bet you, if you can prove that you are who you say you are, and you explain the case, I'm sure this happens all the time. I don't have access to my email, that email anymore. Don't necessarily mention that it was a job and that you're not at that place of employ, just merely say, I don't have access to that email anymore. Can I change that email address without an email to that old address? What they'll want to do is prove that you are you. But if you can do that without access to the old email address in some other way, they'll accept that. You know, with a bill of sale or something will help, you know, call them and see what you can do.
So then
what that'll mean is that you'll have the same iCloud account. So, yes, all your apps will move over and everything. That's going to be the ticket.
I won't even have to restore. Is that what you're saying?
You won't have to restore. You'll just re-log in and everything else. And they'll say, okay, yeah, that's you. Do want to do this because if you don't, I don't even think you can use that iPhone anymore.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in order to prevent theft, I mean, you can use it until it asks you to log in. And then when you can't, I don't know what'll happen.
But I do the fingerprint encryption, so that might help me, right?
No, but let's see. Here's an article. We could put this in the show notes. How to change your Apple ID email address without access to the old address. See, this probably happens quite a bit because people, you know, my Gmail account got discontinued or whatever. Fortunately, as long as you could still log into your Apple ID account at appleid.apple.com, you can change your email address. But you can't, right? Because you don't have – well, wait a minute. You can. You still can log in, right?
Oh, yeah.
You just can't get email.
Yeah, I just can't get the old email.
Yeah, that's fine. They'll ask – what they're going to need to do is identify you for sure, and that means the security questions or something. So you can try it at Apple ID – .apple.com. And what you're going to do, and there's a link there, says change my email address. And if you can validate it without an email to that address, it happens to people all the time, right?
I agree.
Not just losing your job, but all sorts of things. So, yeah, I think you can do this. You're just going to require that you identify yourself somehow.
Great. And would that be the same, because I have the same instance, my daughter, I got her an Apple laptop, and she's not using her iPad anymore. So she said, oh, Dad, you can use it because I could use it for presentations at work. So can I do the same procedure?
No, she has to release it. She has to take it off, find my iPhone, and release it, and then you would attach it to your account.
Okay. So
you'd wipe it and attach it. I presume you want to wipe it, right? Or you just want to use it as is? You could use it as she's using it. You could be her and use it.
And
yeah, that's fine. But if you wanted to take it over, if you want to take over an iDevice and make it yours, previous owner has to release it.
Got it.
And by the way, this is a great lesson for everybody listening. If you have a device you use for your personal stuff, like an iPhone, never, ever use your business address as the email address. Right?
Because then they own you.
They own you. You just gave it to them. So you can even create a Gmail account that you don't use for anything else. In fact, it's not a bad idea. I started doing that because my well-known email address turned out to be less than secure. Somebody tried to hack it by going to my domain registrar. And had they – they didn't. They weren't able to, but had they successfully done that, they could have had all the recovery emails sent to that address. So now I use an unknown address. Nobody knows this, a magic secret address that only I know for all of my top secure logins, like my iPhone. That way, even if somebody knows my address, they don't know how to get my stuff.
Well, Leo, I've enjoyed you for so many years, and even back when you were in so many of the magazines.
I can't believe you remember that.
I couldn't wait till those magazines came out in the trade.
Oh, aren't you kind?
Full-color glossy magazine.
Remember that? Having a computer meant you subscribed to a bunch of magazines.
What were they called? Computer World?
PC Computing, PC Magazine, Windows Magazine, Computer Shopper. That was the biggest. Remember Computer Shopper? You could make furniture out of a year's worth of Computer Shopper. You could build a nice side table. It was so big.
And now that whole cool Atari computer that I liked back then, I thought it was better than the Apple II, quite frankly, because it had the editable screen.
That's why I got it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
now it's in a something that looks like a joystick.
Yeah.
That I bought at Target, and I plug it in the side of my big screen.
I got
and it has like
exactly
games in it.
I got it from my kid for Christmas. Because, and you know what? He loves it. It's one of his favorite Christmas presents. I said, but they're so primitive. He said, yeah, it's fun to go back in time and play those games like when you were a young man. Yeah. I wasn't a kid.
My daughter's 13, and she loves Pac-Man and Rally X.
Yeah, it's fun, isn't it?
We play them against each other, and we don't need a computer. It's just a joystick.
They sell the old Sega games in that form, and they sell old Atari games in that form. It is exciting. Because when I think how much I spent on my Atari 800... putting a floppy drive on, and now what I think it costs, it's kind of amazing. Hey, it's nice to talk to you. Thanks for calling. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls right after this. Our show today brought to you, our podcast brought to you by Carbonite, as always, for a lot of reasons. Carbonite backs up our stuff, so it protects us. Carbonite is more than anything these days, a data protection platform, a robust data protection platform for business. So that means they do, of course, backup, but also disaster recovery. They have high availability backup, which means you're back up and running quickly. Workload migration technology, so you're never locked into any server or system. And their newest solution, Carbonite Endpoint Backup. This is for any business where you have users in multiple locations. And that doesn't just mean multiple offices. It could mean mobile, too, right? Laptops, smartphones, tablets. You need, if you're in a situation like that, if you're distributed, you need hybrid backup and archiving that'll safeguard data wherever your users are without overtaxing network resources. That's really important on smartphones, right? On mobile. Carbonite Endpoint Backup is the only endpoint backup that does true global deduplication of encrypted data. You know why? They're the only ones that do it. They have the patent. And it's brilliant what they did. Very clever. The idea is whether two users or 100 have the same file, you only have one copy, one backup of it. That saves you storage space and money. Of course, it's completely secure and safe, but why make extra copies of the same file, right? So the system uses 256-bit encryption at rest. And here's the key, because normally you can't dedupe encrypted data, but each data set has its own encryption key. In fact, each key is a snippet of your file. So if it's stolen, it only unlocks a small piece of the file, and that's what allows global deduplication of encrypted data. It's amazing. Carbonite Endpoint Backup covers 2 million endpoints in one vault, and you can have as many vaults as you want. So go ahead, grow your business. Carbonite scales seamlessly, and it's absolutely flexibility. You can deploy it in the public cloud, in a private cloud if you prefer. You can do it on premises or any combination of the above. Their quick cache tool is great because it backs up small data sets locally throughout the day over the LAN, which makes everything fast and, of course, up to date. And then your restore speeds are faster, too, 10 times faster. Backup is faster, minimal bandwidth disruption, but you still have that offsite, too. So it's really a great kind of hybrid solution. Carbonite Endpoint Backup. They've also got remote wipe, which is important if you've got mobile devices out there, right? Not just for laptops, it makes phone and tablet backup easy with centralized management, which you can use to set retention and access policies. You can delay backup if you're on cellular or battery. That way, you know, you protect the resources of your mobile devices, and end users have rapid access to any file backed up across any of their endpoints. That's just one of many reasons why Carbonite is the solution, the data protection platform for business. Find out more about Carbonite Endpoint Backup at Carbonite.com. Now on with the show. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. On we go with the calls to Dana Point, California. Don is on the line. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Two quick FYIs you'll like and before my question. One is that I have my CPAP set to airplane mode because I found out that, A, they don't have any security on it and have no intention.
Wow.
And B, it was originally set up to daily contact, send data in.
Wow.
So now I have it set up so that they sent me a couple of cards to stick in, SDC cards.
Update from an SD card instead of over the air.
Right, yeah. And then I just email that information to them.
You know, but this is a big problem. There are a number of medical devices that have no security. We've even heard of, believe it or not, hacks on pacemakers.
And
And they're not going to take your pacemaker out and fix that.
A guy ended up in the hospital because of that.
I mean, I don't know what they would do with a CPAP, make you breathe faster or something. I don't know. But still, medical devices should not be hackable. This is a bad idea.
I figured they would use it as a gateway to the house network.
Yes, exactly right. That's the real threat from IoT devices that aren't secure. Exactly that.
The second one is something that I found really helpful. It is Smart Select for the stylus for my Note 8. In many cases, you can't use copy and paste, especially with web pages. With a Smart Select, you can go in with a stylus, select whatever you want, and it allows you to extract the text from whatever it is you've cut out.
I use it all the time. It's absolutely wonderful. They have that Note has gotten better and better, and that stylus is more and more powerful. They've really done a great job with it.
Now, unfortunately, they don't publicize it. I stumbled on it by accident.
I know. You know, I just found out something on my S9 that I had no idea. You can hide the home buttons at the bottom so they're invisible, and then just press hard on the bottom where it would be, and that works like the home button.
Works with the S8 and the Note 8, too.
Yeah, I never knew that. I had a Note 8 for, forever, and I never knew that.
Okay. Well, here's my question.
Yes.
The Note 8 and the S8 all come with Office products on them, the apps, but I want to utilize Office 365 Personal.
Right.
Want to put that on my laptop and other computers along with the devices. Do you see any conflicts between having all of these Office products?
No, because on the Note 8, you're going to be attaching it to your Office account, your Outlook account, and you'll even be able to see the documents on OneDrive and so forth. It will be the same as, you know, the full desktop version in terms of which account it's attached to and all of that. So, in effect, this is actually great.
Do I really need to keep the old Outlook.com, Excel.com, et cetera?
No. Just download the Android app. Those are a little bit better than the web versions. Although you're perfectly fine to use the web versions. I think, you know, we're going to see this at Microsoft Build, their developers conference is coming up in a month or two. That they're going to be moving towards something they call progressive web apps, that you'll go to Office for the web, you know, Word web, and it will download enough stuff that it actually becomes an app on your phone. And so the distinction between the app version of Microsoft Word and the online web version of Microsoft Word, those distinctions are going to disappear. But for now, the app is more capable. So I would just download the app. It's free on Android. Because you're an Office 365 subscriber, you'll log into your account. All your documents will be there. It actually is a great experience. It's one of the reasons Microsoft is selling these Galaxy phones in the Microsoft stores. And a lot of people who had Microsoft phone, you know, the Windows phone, who have been left in the cold since Microsoft killed Windows phone, have moved to Android and are starting to use these Samsung devices. I think that, you know, the Note 8 is so big with the stylus, it's really a little portable computer, and having Office on there is a great idea. It's the same thing, though, on iOS. They have some of the best Office apps are actually written for iOS. It's let's see. I think I have time for another call. Here we go. Let's see who's on the line from Bakersfield, California. Jan's on the line. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm older, and I'm having issues with hearing. I'm not bad enough that I need a hearing aid yet, but the biggest issue is with my phone. If I don't have it on speaker, I have a really hard time hearing when somebody, you know, when somebody calls or I'm calling out.
Yeah.
I
know what you mean. In fact, when I wear one of the things I like, the hearing aids that I end up getting are work with iPhone, and when my calls come in, I'm actually hearing them in the hearing aids. And that is just so nice. I can completely hear. But hearing aids are ridiculously expensive. So I understand why you might not want to get them.
Well, I'm not ready for it. I mean, my hearing isn't that bad.
Mine's not either, but I still got them.
Well, maybe that's something I'll have to look into.
Yeah, you can look into that. Or you could do much the same thing with just getting some headphones. You know, some headphones for the phone.
What would you recommend?
What kind of phone?
Currently, Luckily, I have a Pixel, but I'm thinking about getting the LG V20 because okay. I really like there's some features so about that phone I really like.
If the phone has a headphone jack, it's a no-brainer, right? Then you just any headphones will work. You just plug it in the headphone jack, then you just turn them up a little bit louder. They sound great. I have to say, this is one advantage. We were talking about Samsung a second ago. One advantage Samsung has. In their sound settings, they have something called Adapt Sound, which I use. You do a hearing test, very much like you do at an audiologist. They play tones, left ear, right ear, left ear. Can you hear that? Can you hear that? And it makes a curve, an equalization curve for your particular hearing, and then boosts it. Because one of the reasons you and I have a hard time hearing voices is in that mid-range. That's often where you start to lose acuity, and so comprehension goes down. So they boost it. And then they sound really good. So the V20 or V30 is a great phone, but you might look at the Galaxy S9 for that alone. And it has a headphone jack. And they come with actually very good AKG headphones. So that next phone. Now, you have the Pixel, the original Pixel or the new ones?
No, the original.
Okay, so that has a headphone jack.
I signed on. Yeah, it does. I signed on with the Project Fi. I think pretty much when it first came out.
Oh, I love. Well, if you want to stay with Fi, you're going to either get a Pixel phone or a Motorola phone. That's the only phones Fi works with.
But the V20 that LG is a Motorola phone. That won't work with it?
No, it's not. It's an LG phone. And it'll kind of work. It'll be a T-Mobile, but you won't get all the benefits of Google Fi. So I don't recommend if you're a Fi customer, you're going to get a Fi phone, which is either a Motorola, a Moto, not an LG, but a Moto, or a Pixel. But so Samsung's out.
The new Pixels are super expensive, and I didn't really want to spend that much.
The V20 is the older, they have a V30 now, so it's less expensive. It's a good choice.
Right, but what I like about the V20, everything is good. I mean, but the V20 has, you can swap out batteries.
I know, it's the last phone in the world that lets you do that. It also, I believe, has a headphone jack, right?
I think it does. Yeah. I've just started doing my research on what phone to switch to. I wasn't, and I was thinking about possibly moving off of Project Fi.
I would just say, you might have to move off Fi if you want to use something besides the Motorola or the Google. But, and LG is not a Fi phone, but... Google may start expanding the Fi program. I mean, they expanded it to include Motorola. That's a big jump, so I hope they'll do that. And the other point, no matter what you get, if you've got a headphone jack or Bluetooth headphones, that will solve the audio problem for voice. It really does, because you can just turn it up a little bit louder and get some equalization. You're going to be in good shape. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. Alan in West L.A. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Leo. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you for calling us today. I appreciate it.
So this may be a basic question, but maybe not that basic a question. You can buy charging cables anywhere. You can buy it over at various kind of electronic stores. It's your 7-Eleven. Of course, you can buy the official one for a particular manufacturer's phone. How much of a difference does it make? And I mention that because I purchase cables from things like Costco and things like that. They work for a while and they stop working, or I can't transfer data with them, or they don't charge quickly, or et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I'm just so kind of curious because it seems like such a basic thing, but maybe it's not.
It's not at all. And, in fact, there's a Google engineer, Benson Leung, who has made has become quite famous because he works on Type-C cables, and he discovered that there was a vast difference in Type-C cables. Some of them have the appropriate resistors, and some of them don't. And those that don't have the appropriate circuitry can actually damage hardware. So he started reviewing on Amazon. He got a tester and set it up and started putting reviews on Amazon saying, don't buy this cable. It'll fry your phone. So that's just as an example. Now, what kind of phone do you have?
I have an Android. So I usually can find something, but then sometimes I'll see something in the bargain bin for a cable for like $2. And if I want to buy a good one, I spend like... $10-15. So yeah.
Is it a Type C charger or is it a micro USB?
Micro USB.
Okay. So everything's being replaced by Type C. Type C does, in fact, have a much more complicated wiring. It's not just a pair, not just a bunch of wires going from one end to the other. And in fact, because these ports on phones are more than charging, they're very often contain data. On newer phones, sometimes they contain more than data. There really can be a difference in cables. Type C is a little dumber. You're a little less likely to have problems with Type C cables. Those are pretty commoditized. So when you're paying more for a Type C cable, you're mostly paying for better construction. It's, you know, a braided cable or better connectors that don't break, that kind of thing. I don't think Type C, I mean, micro USB, the old style, it matters. But again, you can get cables that are not, I mean, if you bought a cable somebody made that didn't connect every pin, yeah, it could not work. But it's not as much circuitry. It's the Type C cables and the Lightning cables that are really finicky. If you have an iPhone, I would absolutely only buy MFI cables, made for iPhone cables, licensed by Apple, because there's a lot of stuff going on in Lightning. And it's similar in Type C. There's many, many different kinds of Type C cables. Some carry data, some charge, some carry higher bandwidth Thunderbolt data, some don't. It's crazy in the Type C world.
Truly amazing. So you said that I can find all this information on Amazon. Is that the
best
place to find that?
Well, I would read the reviews. Again, unless somebody corrects me in the chat room, I don't think you have a problem with micro USB. If there's a problem, it's just a badly made cable, a cheap cable. You know, you don't need to pay $10 for a micro USB cable. You really don't. They should be a couple of bucks. But again, you know, even if you buy on Amazon, you don't really know the provenance of the cable it could be made. You know, there are factories in China. A friend of mine, Bunny Wong, used to make a device called the Chumbi, which was a little alarm clock. It was in a bean bag. And he found that he would get memory cards from the same manufacturer. Some would work, some wouldn't. And he was very puzzled by this. He started investigating, and he found out that the factories in China that made these cards, they would make the good ones during the day. And then they would, at night, with the same machinery and the same labeling and everything, make bad ones that would then they would sell under the table, and it would be a way of making a little extra money. And I think probably the same thing happens with a lot of different electronics devices made in factories around the world, that some of them are junk. So, you know, if you find a company that makes a good cable, I usually get, I'll tell you where, if you're willing to spend a little money, get a braided cable. Those are usually last longer. They're nicer. And anybody who's going to make a braided cable and it's going to cost you $10 is going to have all the wires connected, right?
Something so simple, but it's so complicated.
Yeah. And it is, in theory, could be dangerous if you had the wrong wires connected. But most of the time, it just wouldn't work. Micro USB, don't worry about it. When you get your next Android phone, and it will almost certainly be a Type-C connector, then you really start to have to pay attention. And Benson Leung has become a hero to all of us, because he was the first one to discover this problem, and he's now legendary. And Amazon eventually, after Benson did this for a while, put these reviews up saying, don't buy this cable. Yes, this is approved. Amazon eventually stopped selling cables that weren't Benson Leung approved. They just pulled all the bad cables. And that was a wonderful day of victory for all of us and for Benson. He's really become legendary. If you really, you know, there are some brand names I like. Somebody in the chat room is reminding me I like Anker, A-N-K-E-R. I buy my batteries from them, but they also make cables. There are some good cables out there. I don't think micro USB makes that much of a difference, honestly. Thank you, Alan. Good question, though. I appreciate the call. Paul in Riverside. Hi, Paul. Hello, Paul. Thanks for hanging on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo, thanks a lot for taking my call. Old listener from back, Screensaver, ZD, and all
lovely,
that.
Lovely.
I watch you with a huge dish in my backyard that I got so I could pick up.
Yeah, those were our first and best viewers with the 10-meter band viewers.
Yeah, yep. And that was fun setting up. Anyway, I got a couple of quick questions.
Yes, sir.
I've got to use Chrome all the time.
Good man. Love Chrome.
When I'm logged in on this computer, it's a Dell workstation, and well, not a Civil War station. But anyway, it's a Windows 7.
Yep.
And when I open the contacts, the right side of the screen jumps left and right about three or four characters constantly, and I cannot get rid of it.
Oh, it's like jittering.
Yes. I have a laptop and another desktop. It's clean. This one computer jumps back and forth. I've tried.
And I love it that you're swapping devices to see if it's the monitor or the computer. And you swapped cables, I presume, as well. You're not using the same cable with that computer every time.
No.
Yep.
No.
Try different cables. So now we know it's the computer, right? It's either the video card on the computer.
Right.
Right.
And nothing else, no other screen does it except that one screen for the contacts.
Oh, well, that's interesting. So it's the combination of that computer and that screen.
Exactly.
Because if that computer's on a different monitor, it works fine.
Everywhere else. Yeah. It's not the monitor. It's definitely the software.
Isn't that interesting?
Here's the funny thing. I try to uninstall Chrome, on the program.
Yeah.
And I get this pop-up that says, please close all Google Chrome windows and try again.
Oh, there's one open.
There's nothing open. The task window.
So this jumping screen thing only happens in the Chrome browser. Other programs don't jump?
Internet Explorer's clean. I've tried that.
Okay, this is a really weird problem because it is a combination of a particular monitor, a particular computer, and a particular program. If all three aren't present, you don't get this weird behavior.
Exactly. And I cannot get rid of it, and it's so irritating when
I don't blame you.
Contacts because I can't focus the mouse on anything.
Only thing I can think of, and I really don't know. This is a very weird mystery, but the fact that Chrome thinks there's another thing of Chrome running makes me think that maybe something's going on with Chrome. Chrome does have software to handle displays and so forth. That maybe there is something going on that you have a flaw in Chrome somehow. I would boot into safe mode and really try to uninstall that Chrome. Get rid of all of it and then start over. See if that works. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
I have not tried safe mode.
Yeah, safe mode. Because you can't uninstall, right? Because when you try to uninstall,
yes.
It says you can't uninstall. You got to close this instance of Chrome first.
Exactly, and there's nothing to close. I can't find anything.
This is the only anomaly. I have to think that that's related to this behavior. That maybe the jumping is this screen, no, that screen, no, this, oh no, this window, that. That there is some phantom Chrome that's getting launched when you launch Chrome. Even when you restart it, the first time you use Chrome, it immediately happens, right?
Very first time I ever used it.
Try safe mode. It may not fix it. There's also a Chrome safe mode. If this is a plug-in or something like that, you can load Chrome in a minimal mode.
Is that in settings? Is that in the settings?
Let me see where that is because they move it around.
I'll look for it.
Yeah, there is a Chrome safe mode. Maybe holding down a key. It used to be holding down a shift key. It may be a menu entry. It may be.
I'll search for that
because if there's a plug-in that's running, it will disable all of those. Then you'd at least be able to uninstall it. You want to? It sounds like there's some faulty extension.
Yeah, I think it's a bug in the software.
Almost certainly
in the Chrome somehow, and I just can't figure it out. Hey, one other quick thing, Leo.
Yeah,
I got a Lenovo laptop that about 5 years ago, and it has a AMD A6 processor.
Okay.
And I put in, it has 8 gigs of RAM, and I put in a 500 gig SSD.
Yep.
What I'd like to do is take that SSD out and put it in a newer laptop to get better performance.
Yep.
Because that AMD A6 is pretty old.
Those Athlons are pretty old. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I'm wanting to know the best way to do that. I want to use my same SSD.
Do you want the data that's on the SSD? In other words, do you want that Windows installed to move over with it?
Yes.
That's going to be problematic. If you're willing to wipe the SSD, no problem. But the problem is Windows install has all the drivers, including, you know, motherboard drivers, and it's not going to be, it's going to be challenging. It may work, but it's going to be challenging to get it to work on a different system.
I'd have to call Microsoft and try to work it out, huh?
Well, it's not even, yeah, you'd have that issue also, the activation issue, but even just...
Yeah, see, it came with Windows 7, and I've upped it.
When you install Windows on a machine, in the install process, Windows looks at hardware and decides what to install. There may be components missing, particularly with power management. So...
Right.
There are literally different kernels for Windows depending on the power management capabilities of the machine, things like that. You can try it, just, you know, unplug it, plug it into the new machine, boot it, see what happens. Windows may say, oh, you've got all new hardware, let me plug and play all this new hardware. But really, the best thing would be to wipe that drive and start over, if you ask me.
And just reinstall.
Yeah, yeah. Once, you know...
I got the media creation already downloaded.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah, this machine you're installing on, has it had Windows 10 on it?
I don't have it yet. I just wanted, before I bought something, to try to get an idea.
If you buy a Windows 10 machine and you then put this replace the hard drive, Windows 10 is already activated for that machine. You shouldn't have any activation issues at all.
Oh, so that would be fine. That would work fine.
That would work fine, yeah. You'd want to wipe the drive, yeah.
Sure.
Actually, you wouldn't even need to wipe the drive. You just install Windows on top of it.
Okay, Leo. Thank you.
All right. Hey, thanks for calling in. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's see. I think I get a call in here. Let's say hi to Scott in beautiful downtown Maine. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Leo?
It's going great. What can I do for you today?
Me and my wife are getting my daughter. We bought her an iPhone 7 for her birthday.
Nice gift.
She's only going to be 9 years old.
Oh, wow. What a nice gift. Lucky girl.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's been dying for one.
I bet.
We want to know what the best app or way to lock down the phone is so we can have as much control over it as possible.
Yes. There's one that Megan, let's see, let me think. There are some lockdowns built into the iPhone. But you want something, parental control, that's a little bit more than that. And I don't blame you. I'm trying to remember. Megan had one that I think she really liked. I do a iOS show with her. You should take a look at the parental controls built in, because there's quite a few. You can block apps. You can block features. But then there are companies that offer even more sophisticated controls. What is it particularly... you'd like to do for her?
Well, you know, we were concerned about being able to control who can call and who she can call.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, stuff like that. I've heard that there's apps that you can just put in, you know, certain numbers, and those will be the only ones allowed.
That's the best, in my opinion, that's the best way to do parental controls. There are, you know, filter programs, the so-called blacklists, but I don't think those work as well as what we call whitelists. Blacklists, you know, actively look for things and try to block bad things. Whitelists are much more what you describe, where you say, well, here's who can call her. Here's who can email her. Here's, you know, and that kind of thing. And I think, frankly, that's a better way to go. But I don't know. I'm looking to see if there is such a thing for the iPhone. Part of the problem is that the iPhone, and this is Apple in general, Apple really doesn't give third-party apps access to things like the phone. So they don't keep people. They can't. I don't know if there's a way to keep somebody from calling your daughter. You might have to. In that case, you might be able to do that though through the carrier.
It's, okay.
Yeah, so that would actually be a better way to do it. The iPhone itself has restrictions on, for instance, what the kid can download, what apps the kid can use, whether she can make in-app purchases. That's actually most parents' biggest worry, is their kid's going to start playing a game and then start buying stuff.
We already started going through it and doing those, the app restrictions and all that.
Yeah. There are some, you can have restrictions on the browser, You can even disable the browser if you want and download a kid-friendly browser. I don't see anything. Yeah, but and that's all built in the Apple parental controls. But I don't see anything, and maybe the chat room can help me. I don't see anything that will say only these people can call. There are email services for kids, which you can set up and have her connect to with Apple's mail program that will let you create a whitelist for email. And that's a great idea. But what we really want, those are the number of those. But what you really want, I agree with you, is only accept phone calls from these numbers. And even more importantly, only accept text messages from these numbers. And I don't know if you, I don't know of a way, and that doesn't mean there isn't one. Let me see if we can whitelist iPhone messages, because that's what we really want to do. I would guess, who's your carrier for this phone?
AT&T.
I would guess that AT&T, of course, has ultimate control of what phone numbers can call and what messages can come through. If they don't have something like that, boy, they really ought to.
All right.
I would call AT&T and ask them.
All right.
Yeah, I can see. Let's see. Yeah, I don't see a way to Apple Messages. That's really the one. If I had a 9-year-old, I'd really want to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
There's something called iBlacklist that says you can filter phone calls and SMS with iBlacklist.
iBlacklist.
It uses... okay. This is from iClarified. This might do exactly what you want. This is a fairly old article I'm looking at, but that's something to search for. iBlacklist. And that actually, ironically, is an iWhitelist, really. And that's what they should call it, except nobody probably knows what a whitelist is. But that will let you say, let's see. You can filter them. They can create a whitelist with this, which is what you want. You say, only phone calls from Grandma, Aunt Judy, Mom, and Dad. Only messages from these five people, and that's what you really want.
Yes, that's exactly what we're
looking for. Take a look at that. It's from iClarified.com, iClarified.com.
Awesome.
Okay, and if we find anything else, we'll put it in the show notes. That's at TechGuyLabs.com. That's the place to put everything, because I know you're driving around, you're busy, and you can't get in, and or you're listening and you want to write something down, but you don't have a free hand, don't worry. TechGuyLabs.com is the website. It's free. There's no sign up. There's no charge. And we just, James writes down everything I say and puts it up there as quickly as he can after the show. We also put audio and video from the show. Let's see. So I'm seeing the chat rooms making some other suggestions. Something called Our Pact. This was best parental control app and family locator. Yeah, this is the one I think my partner on iOS Today, Megan Maroney, was talking about. The essential app for parents, RPAC, parental control and family locator. Block internet and apps. Instantly grant access to your child's device during a manual block or schedule. Schedule device use. Block texting. Yeah, this looks good, too. I would look at that. OURPACT.com. This is the kinds of things that typically are hard to do on an iPhone because Apple is so restrictive. They don't want, and understandably, for security reasons, they don't want you to be able to install apps that change how the phone works, that blocks phone numbers and stuff, for security reasons, because if an app could do that, then an app that just said, oh, no, I'm just a wallpaper app, could do that and do it maliciously. So as part of their security model for the iPhone, they're very restrictive on what third-party apps could do. On the other hand, anybody who wants to give an iPhone to a kid, and that every kid wants one, would like to have some control over that. So it's a balancing act. Verizon has family support for family controls. I bet you AT&T does as well. So there's a few things you can look at. And anything more, go to the website, techguylabs.com. We've got a comment section. You can add your thoughts and suggestions. That's a nice thing to do because, you know, I think over time, the idea is that that website will always be there. It'll always be free, I promise. And so that will always be a resource for people. We've got a good search there, and we've got more than 1,482 shows there. That's a lot of information. And so access to that And getting the answers there is great, but that's even better if you can leave your thoughts, your additions. And I know there are parents out there who have solved this issue. Let's take a break. More to come. I'll take more of your calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. This episode of the Tech Guy brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. You heard me talk about Rocket Mortgage. Maybe it's time to buy a new house or, you know, as interest rates go up, maybe time to refi. You should ought to look at Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage comes from Quicken Loans, and you know that name, I'm sure. They're the number one lender in the country. Also number one in our hearts. J.D. Power says number one in customer satisfaction for 8 years in a row. Soon it'll be 9. They realized, the folks at Quicken Loans, that the home loan experience was really kind of dated. They decided to streamline it, to do it something no one had done before, completely online home loan approval, completely online. It's called Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. And you do the whole thing. You could be at a home open house, you know, looking at a house, say, hey, let's buy this. Now you go in your browser on your phone to rocketmortgage.com/tech guy. You answer some questions you know the answer to. You don't have to do research or, honey, what was your income in 2010? Do you remember? Where did we live in 2004? Do you remember that? You don't have to rack your brain for anything. Just answer a few simple questions. Because Rocket Mortgage has relationships with all the financial institutions, with your permission, they get all the information they need. They crunch the numbers. They do it fast. Based on your income and your assets and your credit, they're going to say, this is what you qualify for. You choose the rate. You choose the term. You choose the down payment. You get the loan. And all of that, from beginning to end, minutes. Most cases, under 10 minutes. You could do it and not leave the open house. You could just say, let's look some more, and I'll just do this here. Nah, nah, nah. And before you go, say, hey, by the way, we'd like to make an offer. We're approved. We're approved. RocketMortgage.com/tech guy. Apply simply. Understand fully. Mortgage confidently. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. And MLSConsumerAccess.org. Number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/tech guy. RocketMortgage.com/tech guy. Bookmark it now so you'll be ready. You never know when that great new house, you know, hits you. In fact, it's always been that way. Every last few times I bought a house, it's not been that we were looking. We just saw something. And we went, oh, ooh, we really ought to move here. This would be great. RocketMortgage.com/tech guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. And it's time for the photo guy, Chris Marquardt. Yes, he's back from Svalbard. And all the ice has melted from his beard. So now he can he can talk freely with full mouth motions. Hello, Chris. Good to talk to you. Welcome back.
You'd be surprised. I even had one occasion where I had ice on my beard a little bit.
I'm not surprised. I saw your pictures from the 78 degrees north. Holy cow.
But my hands were too cold to take a picture of it, so you'll have to take my word for it.
No selfies. No selfies with the ice in the beard. He's too cold. What do you want to talk about this week, Mr. Chris?
Well, not a travel adventure this time, but I thought it was good to kind of go back to the roots, talk a bit about some of the basics of photography, and what I want to talk about today is contrast.
Oh, good.
You know, the thing that when you shoot black and white, when you take all the colors out, you only have contrast, right? And contrast is light and dark in the picture. And the bigger that difference between the light and the dark in the picture, the more contrast you have. So,
let me go back through this because I want to understand this. So this is the definition of contrast. No color, and the difference between the darkest and the brightest is the contrast.
That's the basic definition. That's the maximum contrast in a picture. If you are out on a sunny day, you have very bright colors and very bright lights and very dark shadows. That's a lot of contrast. When it's a foggy day, when it's an overcast day, you have very little contrast.
Actually, that makes sense because when you do the contrast slider, if I reduce contrast, everything looks like it's foggy. It's all
That's pretty much what it is. Yeah, when it's foggy, it's little contrast. And contrast is on the one side, it's a technical thing. Your camera kind of has a range that it can act in, so it has a limit when it comes to the brightest area and a limit when it comes to the darkest thing that it can show. So that's, we call it contrast range or dynamic range. But there are also some creative function of contrast. A contrast between two things in a picture means they will be easily differentiated in the photo. So let's say you shoot a picture of a person in a white suit in front of a black wall. that person will stand out really well. If that same person wears a black suit in front of the black wall, it'll probably partially look like it's disappearing because it melts into the background.
Ah, there's no edge between the two.
Yeah. Exactly. So helping a subject stand out, you can do this using contrast. You can do this by placing your subject in front of something that is of a different brightness. That's one area where contrast comes in. There's also another area where that we call contrast, and it's color contrast, which pretty much means, are the colors between things similar? Like, let's say you have a person with a blue suit in front of a blue wall, or is it opposite colors? That would be complementary colors, like a person with a red suit in front of a green wall, for example, which is a strong contrast. And that's the first is the brightness contrast, second is the color contrast. And you can use those to create certain moods. And of course, I'm not saying one or the other is better. I mean, if lots of contrast or little contrast is not a measure of quality. And if I look at some of my photos, I've shot some of my very best photos of very low contrast photos where you almost see nothing, and then there's this one little shape of maybe a tree in
That's
the fog emerging
of.
From
yes.
Yeah, emerging from nothing pretty much. Makes for very interesting photos. So lots of contrast is beautiful. I like it. A lot of my photos have a lot of contrast, but then some photos are very different, have very little contrast, and that works as well. So that's not a measure of quality. Now we get to the third kind of contrast, and that's the content. That's what the photo is about. And of course, you can have a lot of contrast there too. I mean, example, old versus new. Look at old cities. You have been to Europe, you've seen a lot of like old castles, but then there's like a modern building right next to one. So you have this old versus new contrast, or an old person and a young person. That's some very interesting contrast there. Or, well, the thing I've just been to, the Arctic, you have a lot of hot and cold contrast there, indoors, outdoors, being inside a warm place, shooting out through a window where it's really cold, for example. Or you could contrast something like things that are artificial versus things that are natural. Or let's say architecture versus nature. And these are kind of shots that you can find everywhere where there's trees and meadows and things, parks in cities, even in New York, you can find that. Or clean versus dirty. Again, any big city, pretty much, you can find that. So contrast in brightness, contrast in color, or contrast in content.
That's a really great distinction because, as you said, in black and white, for instance, there's no rule. More contrast isn't necessarily better. But I do have to think that when you're talking about contrasting subjects, that is often very compelling in a picture.
That's cold. What helps you tell the story with the picture.
Yeah.
If you have contrasting subjects, contrasting content in a picture, that'll get people's minds moving. Frankly, it's not you as the photographer who's telling the story. It's the person looking at the photo who tells themselves the story.
Right,
so they are making that story up based on what you show them. And if you have contrast in a photo, that is a very good basis for having people think about it, work through it in their minds, maybe even come back to the photo. And in times where we have gazillions of photos every day, that's a pretty important thing.
Yeah, and just like you said, sometimes turning the contrast down can also be good. I'm thinking of there are great images with things that are the same, that repeat over and over again. There's no contrast there. It's the same, and you're so extreme that's very compelling. So, as usual, there's no rule, except it's a great thing to pay attention to.
Now, there's one last function that contrast has, and it's as a depth indicator. If you look in landscapes, the things that are further away have less contrast.
Yeah.
You'll see this, for example. You have definitely seen photos where you have a mountain range and you have mountains behind mountains, and the further away they get, the less contrast they have, the more hazy it looks back there.
Right.
And that's just a normal thing because the atmosphere, some of the sunlight gets scattered and turns into blue light, and that is what you see, and that's what reduces the contrast. And that is a depth indicator. That's when you look at older Disney films, even newer ones, they use that pretty well to indicate depth in something that's only two-dimensional. And when you look in today's software, like Lightroom, for example, now has a dehaze slider. Ah. It's a little slider that takes some of that haze out. Ah. I would suggest to not overuse that. Some people tend to like take all that haze out because, hey, it doesn't belong there. No, it has a function. It's there for a reason. It helps people see the depth in your photo. So don't overdo that haze slider because you might actually destroy some of that depth in the picture.
You know what? That's why this is an art. There's no magic rule in any direction. It's all about your eye and thinking about it and what you want to say with the picture. But it is a great tool. Contrast, you can use it in many ways. I really like that. Now, Chris, you're going to be doing a lot of traveling. What are we going to do about the photo contest? What is our photo contest this month or months?
The new assignment is foot.
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 Now that could be 12 inches or a foot. You get to decide, right?
Well, depends on your culture. We don't do feet here, but so from Europe you might get more feet, more actual feet.
And from America we might get the imperial system.
Awesome.
Take a picture, upload it to Flickr, tag it with the word foot, submit it to our tech guy group. Renee Silverman will welcome you, and in a few weeks, Chris will review your photo assignment. It is foot. Find more, Chris, at discoverthetopfloor.com. Great photos and, of course, many workshops and books, too. Thank you, Chris. We'll talk again next week.
Absolutely.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go, and on the line two, Jay from Anaheim. Thanks for hanging on, Jay. Jay, are you there?
Yeah, Leo, I thought you said Jay, but this is Jerry in Anaheim.
Oh, I did say Jay, but I will call you Jerry from now on. I'm sorry. Oh. Hi, Jerry.
I don't know if this is a record or I'm coming close to a record. Third time I called in
okay.
over the past years, and the third time I've had to chance to say hello and talk to you.
Well, it is kind of a record, and I'm glad you did. Thank you, Jay.
Because Jerry.
I'm going to stop reading that thing that says Jay. Thank you, Jerry, and I appreciate your call. I presume that my previous two attempts to help you were at least somewhat successful. You wouldn't be calling back.
The first one, which a long time ago, you weren't able to come up with an answer.
Oh, man.
No, that's cool. I was able to use the non-fixing to switch over to Apple.
Ah, okay. So you're now an Apple guy.
Yeah, I was one of those guys that could sit by his computer, don't touch it, and a week later it would be all screwed up. So I went to Apple, more than happy.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. The concern I have now, and I'll delete most of the stuff I did ahead of time, which was I just wiped everything out and started all over with the help of Apple. Lately, the last week or so, I go on my iMac. I don't think it does it on my laptop or Facebook or iPad.
Yeah.
I go to Facebook, not all the time, but once in a while, all of a sudden, it's like somebody is taking it over, and it scrolls real quick, loading up the pages and taking them up to the top like you're scrolling down to find something.
Okay. But does it end up at the bottom?
Well, it'll scroll, and then it'll be like you've scrolled and everything was loaded, and then you got to the point where it needed to stop so it could load some more. Then it would load some more, and then all of a sudden,
it just keeps going, in other words.
Yeah.
Wow. And this this only happens on Facebook. If you go to another page that has scrolling, it doesn't happen there?
No.
You go to other pages, right? I mean, I know there are people who just go to Facebook. You do go to some other pages from time to time.
Oh, yeah, yes.
And you're not getting the scrolling behavior anywhere else but Facebook?
So far, yes.
That's
only
weird.
Facebook. And the other thing is, I can use my cursor. It doesn't take control of the cursor, so I can move it off of Facebook, go up and try to shut it down. And a couple of times, I cannot duplicate it. It makes a long, low tone as opposed to high pitch burr sound. And I try to shut it off, then I just hit the shut off button in the back. And,
okay. Yeah, so the reason I asked if it happens anywhere, are you using Safari or some other browser?
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason I ask is because if it were a stuck key or a stuck scroll wheel on your mouse, you know, that's the first thing people think of. Well, some, you know, like the down arrow key is stuck, or the page down key on your keyboard is stuck. But if that were the case, it would happen more than just on Facebook. It's only happening on Facebook.
Okay. One more concern that might help you a little bit.
Yeah.
I've also been getting recently, not all the time, the warning your account has been logged in from another location you don't normally are at.
And do you ever log in anywhere else?
I log in at the mall and
stuff. Yeah, that's where. That's,
they tell me I'm logging in at Inglewood and Hawthorne, California.
Yeah, you can't be. So that's just a failing of the geolocation system. If remember, most
concerned somebody's taken over.
Yeah, here. No. If it's somewhere nearby, but not exactly where you are, it's because the computer at the mall doesn't have a GPS system in it. So what Facebook's looking at is the internet address you're logging in from, and that address isn't really tied to the mall. It's tied to the mall's internet service provider, and that could be in Hawthorne. I mean, I wouldn't worry too much about that. If you get a login from Dubai,
well, no, this also happens.
Or St. Petersburg. Yeah, yeah. That's okay. I wouldn't worry too much about that.
Okay, good.
That's almost certainly you. Just the geolocation system is very imperfect. Now, let's talk about this.
As you well know, you answer yes or no, and if you say no, that's not me, you got to reset your password.
Yeah, don't say no. Say yes.
If you logged in at Inglewood,
yeah. If nothing else is suspicious, if it's a time that you actually probably were using the computer, if it's possibly that day you were at the mall, or that's fine. If it's in the middle of the night when you couldn't possibly have been using the computer, that might be cause for concern. You've changed your password, though, since that's happened, since I think you have answered no. So we know that your password is now secure again. So
yeah. I'm going to go to LastPass.
Good man. A sponsor, but I think it really will change your life. And another thing to do with Facebook, and any account that allows this, by the way, is turn on two-factor authentication. Facebook, and it won't bother you. The only time you'll ever see this is the first time you use a browser or a computer. It'll say, well, you need the code from your Facebook app, or you need a code generator. Code, or we can text you a code. Turn that on. It's in the Facebook settings. That'll keep any bad guy from stealing your computer. The one thing sometimes to worry about is when you do log on a public computer, like at the mall, it's not unusual for you. You know, it's possible that you entered the password and it got logged, or somebody noticed it, or you stayed logged in. You forgot to log out. So if you do use public computers, it's not a bad idea. Turn on that two-factor and make sure that when it asks, are you in a public computer, you say yes. That way it won't preserve the password. Now, moving on to your scrolling problem, I think almost certainly this happens to browsers. Browsers, as you know, have a good memory. They're like elephants. The first time you visit a page, they load in a lot of the content from that page. And then every subsequent visit, they say, do we know anything about that? Oh, yeah, we do. We have that all cached, is what they call it. And we'll just load from the cache. That saves you a time and bandwidth. The cache can get corrupted, though. And when the cache is corrupted, it can break the program. Safari says, oh, let's load in the cache. And it's gobbledygook. And Safari goes, bleh, 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 and maybe does some of that scrolling thing. So whenever a browser misbehaves like this, and it's very specific, I mean, it's not happening on any other program, it's not even happening in the browser and any other page, it seems likely to me that it's the Facebook cache, you know, the cache from that site is corrupt, it's damaged. So I would say a good idea would be to reset Safari. Now, you should know that, there are a variety of levels of resetting. The most extreme will start you over as if you've never used it before. So if you've been using it to remember passwords or cookies and things like that and extensions, that's going to reset you. It's going to be like you're using a brand new computer. So you might start with just, for instance, clearing Safari's web caches. It's in the advanced section of the Safari preferences. You have to show the develop menu. They don't want to scare people with this. So there's a developer's menu. You can turn it on in the advanced preferences. And then in that menu, empty caches. Try that first. That'll do the least damage. That'll just mean the first time you go back to that page, it takes a little bit longer. There are also ways to remove website data, cookies, passwords, and that's in the privacy section of the Safari preferences. You can also disable extensions, and that's something I do a lot on browsers because extensions can always give you a problem. So if you go to the extensions setting of Safari's preferences, yes, another location, there's a slider that turns off extensions. You can also, in the security preferences, disable plugins. All of that can be done a piecemeal till you see what went wrong. If none of that works, then you want to get rid of the Safari folder in your library. That you don't have to delete it. You can just move it to the desktop and see if that helps. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. These are kind of scorched earth techniques, but I think there's something that sounds like there's something wrong in the cache. And I don't think that's typical of Facebook at all. So I think I'm gonna point in that direction. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go, and on line four, Ed in Rialto, California. Hey, Ed.
Hi, Leo. I'm looking for a program that will rip YouTube videos. A long time ago, I think in my XP days, you directed us to a program that would do that. And we downloaded it, I downloaded it, and it'd have a little flag up in the upper right corner of the video that would come on when you move the pointer there that would say save, I believe.
Right.
You push on that, and then everything was magically done. And then as time went on, it just would not work anymore. Something about, codecs or something
yeah.
changed.
Yeah, so YouTube, the whole idea when people stream on YouTube, the presumption is that you're not, in fact, downloading it. You can, I seem to remember there was some subscription model for YouTube where you could download, but normally you don't get to download and save YouTube videos. However, you are in fact getting a streaming version of a video. You should be able to save it. And in fact, it's not that hard. There are a lot of ways to do it now, and most of them do it kind of online. So try this one. This is an example. I don't know if it has to be a standalone program for you, but when you're going to a YouTube site, if you put the letters PP, as in Paul, after YouTube, so it'd be youtubepp.com, and everything else the same, it will download the video.
Okay. Yeah, I'm into air shows and radio-controlled stuff, and I know with YouTube, here today, gone tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons they do it that way, is that YouTube kind of, I don't know. And I don't think this is illegal to do, but here's how you do it. That's one of many, but this is a company called y2mate.com, and the way they make it possible makes it so easy to do that it's generally just the simplest way to do it is to add PP to the word YouTube when you do the download. You'll get a download button. There are other converters, many of them. If you look at download YouTube, you'll see a ton of different ways to do it. The big one, I think, is onlinevideoconverter.com.
Ah.
Online video. But it's the same thing. Basically, you'll go to a website, you'll paste the YouTube link in, you say what format you want it in, and they have a broad variety of formats, both audio and video, and it will also download. So it's web-based, basically. That's what's happened, is that they're not standalone apps anymore.
Okay, then.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. I wonder... Does anybody know? Is that illegal? Keepvid.com is another one. I like the Y2Mate because you just add the letters PP to YouTube. So YouTubePP.com, same address, and it just does it. But if you want more features and that kind of thing, online video converter is good. JDownloader, they've been around forever, JDownloader.org. Probably, if you read the YouTube terms of service, it would probably say something about this. Savefrom.net. I'm trying to think why. I think it's because the content creators don't want to lose control of it, right? They don't want you to download it. But after all, there is no difference, really, between streaming video and downloading it. In order to stream it, you download all exactly the same bits and you play it back. The bits have to go to your computer. So if you're saving those bits, I don't know, doesn't seem so wrong to me, but I'll leave it to the lawyers. Jim in Bonnie Lake, Washington. Hello, Jim. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. First, I want to ask you if I can stow away in your suitcase. I want to go to Japan.
I wish I could take everybody. Oh, that'd be so much fun to take the whole tech guy audience. Then I wouldn't have to record shows.
Yeah, there you go.
I could just take y'all
from over there.
Well, I thought about that, and of course that would be easy, but there's a couple of things. One is that the time zone would mean that I'm doing it in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
The other and I've done that. I was in Australia, did a show from Australia. It was like 3 a.m. The other problem, of course, is it wouldn't be much of a vacation if I had to do my job, so but we're recording a bunch of shows, so nobody's going to miss anything. Yep. What and you're helping. So what can I do for you?
I bought an Inspire on 11/31/62 here several months ago, and twice now I've had an anomaly occur here.
I think I lost the audio. Are you there? I'll wait a second. Sometimes it's
for a Windows 10, they run out of room. And this particular model it says 28 gigabyte of hard drive on it. And so
So the total amount of room on the tablet is 28 gigs.
That's what it says.
Yeah. That's before you put Windows in your programs and data on it, right?
Yes.
So
probably
I would check and see what the free amount is. If it's it's funny because I've had Windows computers. I remember when I got a 2 gigabyte hard drive, I was pretty darn excited. There was plenty of room for Windows, but that was probably Windows 98. That was a long time ago. So
anyway, I went searching for what was taking up so much room. And I went into a file path that from the PC users, the name of my computer, app data, local, and I've come up with a file that is holding 9 gigabytes in it that has nothing in it. And I have the hidden files turned on. There's virtually nothing in this file called DBG. Any ideas?
I don't off the top of my head, but I sure as heck don't want you to delete it. If it happens to be the swap file, that would be bad.
Well, that's what I did. I deleted it, and then I wound up putting the clean copy.
Yeah.
Install back on it.
Good. User data is really temp files. So chances are you're probably okay in that directory. But I would be careful. Windows 10 has a cleanup utility, disk cleanup. Search for disk cleanup. Hit the Windows key, type disk cleanup. I would prefer to use that. Disk cleanup gets more aggressive if you press the cleanup system files button in there. That way you're not deleting something that's needed for operation, like the swap file. It'll delete, and it takes a while to do that. It'll delete all the temp files, and most of that is stored in that user data folder. So since it's still working, good news. You didn't delete anything critical. I'm tempted to think that that's the swap file, but who knows? 9 gigabytes is awfully big. No, out of sync says you don't have to worry. That's the swap file is in the root directory. It's called page file. Okay. So, yeah, this is why Microsoft offers this tool. And I understand they're going to change the name when the next version of Windows, the spring update or whatever they end up calling that, comes out any day now. But you don't have it yet. That's the good news. Almost certainly you don't have it yet unless you're on the Windows Insider program. So go hit the Windows key, type disk cleanup. You'll find a little desktop app that says disk cleanup. And there's a button that says clean up system files. Definitely do that. If that's not enough, then go to more options. You can delete system restore, shadow copies. You can even remove programs you don't use. 32 gigs is right on the edge. You know, there are actually 8-gigabyte tablets out there, Windows tablets out there, that can't upgrade. That cannot upgrade. They're just too full. And you're stuck with whatever version you're there. But 32 should be enough. But yes, it's easy enough to fill up 32 gigs nowadays. Isn't that funny? I mean, we thought, oh, I will never run out of room with 2 gigs. Actually, I go far enough back that my first hard drive was 5 megabytes. Oh, I will never run out of room with 5 megabytes. I couldn't fit one of my pictures on that now. It's too big to fit on that. 8888 Ask Leo. Thanks for the call. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Stay right here. Lots more coming up. Show today brought to you by LastPass. I think this is a kind of a habit I have. We try to do advertisements for stuff we use already that we know we love, and we can say, you know, you ought to try this. And LastPass is absolutely it. It was a few years ago now. Steve Gibson, I'd been using LastPass for years. He connected up with the author of LastPass, Joe Segrist. Joe showed him all the code, showed him exactly what he's doing, and Steve said, thumbs up, LastPass. Steve uses it. I use it, but more than that, we use LastPass Enterprise for our business, which is really great. In fact, I believe in LastPass so much. So we got the LastPass Enterprise subscription. That way all of the, you know, I'll tell you why we did it. We had a guy, no names, who put online in a public page all of our passwords so he could remember them. Needless to say, it doesn't work here anymore. However, that was when we said we got to do something. So we got LastPass. And you know what? Your business is in the same boat. You need LastPass. And I believe in it so much, it's one of the company benefits we offer, a free LastPass personal subscription as for everybody who works here. So we have LastPass for our business passwords. We have LastPass personal for all our employees. By the way, you can do this. You can merge them both so that each stays private, but you only have one LastPass vault that has a section of it that's for your business stuff and a section of it for your personal stuff. I really like that feature. And LastPass works everywhere I do. All my devices. I even use LastPass on Linux because it's got Chrome extension, Firefox extension, Safari extension. What else? Edge. So Internet Explorer, you can use it anywhere. Of course, if there's LastPass apps for Windows and Mac, I often do that. Those really work well. It works on Windows S, Windows 10S, UWP. Yep, there's a store app for LastPass. And, of course, Android and iOS, too. So that means when you create a new account or open a site or, you know, even serial numbers, it's in there and it's accessible. So if I create an account on the desktop and I go there on my phone, I log in. I already have the password because LastPass has it, and it fills it right in for me. It is the easiest way. As you know, I set up new phones all the time. Easiest way to set up a new phone, a new system. And you just have this peace of mind that your stuff is always safe. AES 256-bit encryption. Trust no one encryption. They don't have access to the encryption key for your vault. Everything's in your vault. You only have to remember now one password, the last password you'll ever remember, which is your LastPass vault password. And, of course, mine's very long and complicated, but I have that one memorized. And I don't have to remember anything else, which means I don't reuse passwords anymore. It has a great security check feature, which you can go through and check all your passwords. Make sure you haven't duplicated. Replace the duplicated ones with a single push of the button. It's a lot of automation, which makes it very easy to do the right thing with all your passwords. I like the emergency access feature, where you can designate a survivor. So if you die, this is a big problem. You know, people pass away and they're all their bank stuff, everything's locked up. With LastPass, and I did this, I've designated my daughter and my wife as my survivors. If I pass away, they can get access to my vault. There's a whole process to make sure that, you know, they don't do it without my permission. It sends you an email. If you don't respond, you set the period of time. If you don't respond in a week or 2 weeks or a month, then they get access. And, of course, because I've died, I can't respond. I can't respond. But that's real. I for me, that's peace of mind. I don't have to – you know, we're on a trip, right? I'm thinking, oh, I should probably write everything down, right? No, I don't have to. It's all been done by LastPass. I can go on and on. I just think, really, if you're not using LastPass, you should. Even if you're using a different password vault, and good on you if you are, because everybody should, this is the one you want. It's the easiest, the best. It's just fantastic. LastPass. They have LastPass products for all size people. I mean, we've got the enterprise product, but they got one for teams, for smaller teams. They've got families, for your entire family. By the way, that's another great feature. I can share passwords with Lisa. So she says, what's the Comcast password? I want to log in. I don't have to tell her. I don't have to email it to her. That's not safe. I share it with her on LastPass. I can even say whether she can change it or not. LastPass Premium for personal use at work and at home. Just, you know, do the right thing. Fix your password woes. Secure yourself with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Find out more at LastPass.com/twit. I am thrilled that they support the Tech Guy Show. LastPass.com/twit. Now back to the show. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, and we go back to the phones on the line. Brian from Indiana. Hello, Brian.
Brian,
speak to me. Are you there?
Hello, Mr. Laporte.
Yes. I'm here. I'm sorry to keep you on hold so long. Thank you for your patience.
No problem. My problem is I've got a lot of Raspberry Pis.
Oh, I love Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I've got one running a Kodi box.
Nice.
And another one running DNS server.
Holy cow. Are you using Pi Hole?
Yeah, Pi Hole.
Pi Hole.
Yeah.
I love that name.
It's great.
So I should explain for people who are saying, what are they talking about? The Raspberry Pi is a $35 computer that's just a marvel. It's made mostly for students and people who want to hack and experiment. But really, it's powerful enough to do a lot of things. The Pi Hole is software you put on a Raspberry Pi to block advertisers and so forth. It makes it a little router that you put in your house, and it cleans up the internet as it's coming into the house. It's a great solution. Kodi is a set-top box media player, another good use for Raspberry Pi. And at $35, you know, you might as well have dozens of them all over the place.
Yeah, I've got several. And I like hooking them up to an HDMI on my TV, you know.
Right. I presume your Kodi's hooked up that way, right?
Yeah. And the switch I have is a Fosman HD 1832, which just died on me.
Ugh.
And because
you have an HDMI switch because you have multiple devices going into a single HDMI port on your TV. Is that how it works?
Right.
Yeah. And I've used HDMI switches. They're universally a terrible experience.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they're cheap. I used to use Geffen. Fosdem's fine. I've used Fosdem. Geffen is another company that makes these. You know, they claim they can auto switch. Never works. They break easily. I mean, it's just what I ended up doing, I'm not recommending this necessarily, but what I ended up doing is just buying an AV receiver, which is effectively a fancy HDMI switch. My AV receiver, I have a Denon with 7 HDMI ports in, so I can have up to 7 devices. And then, actually, this one I think has 2 HDMI outs. I'm not sure why. So that's, and then you just use, just like any receiver, you use the remote control and receiver to pick which thing is on. And if CEC is working with the device, it'll automatically switch. And that actually works fairly well. But again, that's going to set you back $100 or more. I'll tell you what, it's the best way to go because then the audio is switched. You can actually drive speakers if you want. I've never had good results with HDMI switchers. Let me ask if the chat room has a suggestion. They say go to Mono Price, and I would agree with that. That's the place to get these kinds of things. I think it's just because it's just the nature of the beast. You know, you need something with a little bit more than just mechanical switches. You need some smarts. Part of the problem is handshaking, right? HDMI handshaking is a terrible experience. That's because the Raspberry Pi has certain capabilities, the TV has certain capabilities, and they have to talk to each other over HDMI and negotiate what the screen resolution is going to be, what the bit rate's going to be, do you do HDR? No. Do you do Dolby? Yeah, okay. And it just never works. And you switch, and then the whole thing starts over again.
Right.
Talking to each other, and it's blinking, and it's black. It's just a really terrible experience.
That was my experience when I purchased this new Raspberry Pi B Plus.
Oh, you have a new one? You have the new one?
Oh, yeah. I've got the new one, and I was having a nightmare with the switch because I thought I was doing something wrong booting it up, and it was just blank on my screen. I removed the switch. It worked fine.
Yep.
You know.
That's the sign, right? What you do is you take the switch out of the equation, you plug directly in the TV. Oh, everything's fine.
Oh,
so the switch is getting away with the hand shaking. Yeah.
That's why I was asking for what's a good switch? Just remove it. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, my experience has always been that an AV receiver, and I use them everywhere now, is a better way to go. And, you know, if you have a 4K or UHD TV and you know, then you want to get a 4K receiver. I mean, even if the HDMI coming out of the Raspberry Pi is only HD, which is the case, you may end up getting a 4K device and so forth. So, you know, there's a huge range of prices. I like Denon. I like Onkyo. Both are excellent. You know, that's certainly one way to go. I don't see a strong recommendation on here for a good HDMI switch. As I said, I've used GEFEN Geffen's. The chat room is saying Monoprice. At least Monoprice doesn't overcharge you for
switcher. Monoprice.
It may be that HDMI switch you have is older and doesn't support the newer HDMI protocols. You know, they do upgrade HDMI from time to time, and I wouldn't be surprised if that Raspberry Pi is doing a more modern.
The newest Pi is doing something different, and that's why I was pulling my hair out with this switch.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, it seems like that's kind of a universal experience. But you like the new, what is it? Is it the B Plus? What do they call it?
Yeah, the B Plus.
Yeah, you like it?
I don't see a whole lot of difference. Yeah. I got it because it was new, and I just needed a new toy to play with.
Yep. I've been thinking about getting one myself. The Raspberry Pi is a really, I'll tell you, if you have kids and you want them to become more than just, consumers of content on their computers, it's a great way to introduce them to computing. It's a programming. There's a Minecraft for Raspberry Pi Microsoft puts out that has Python interface, so you can learn how to program Python. And I'll tell you, there's no kid alive, no Minecraft kid alive, that doesn't love the idea of making a dynamite bridge and then blowing it up. And you can do that with a couple of lines of code. It's a great way to learn programming. Anyway, I get an AV receiver. I think that's the best solution. It's nice to talk to you, Brian. I appreciate it. Raspberry Pi 3B Plus, I think, is the latest model. And they just keep getting better and better and better. Sony makes a $148 AV receiver, according to Irvine Robb. That's not a bad price. It's on Amazon. We'll put a link on that in the show notes. The Sony receivers are good. At $148, you know, it's costing maybe $50 to $100 more than an HDMI switch, but it's going to do a lot more. Then you get speakers. You can have nice surround sound. You can, you know, life will be better. Life's always better when you spend money, at least for the merchants. Let's see here. Show line 3 is Mike in Highland, California. Hi, Mike.
How you doing?
I'm well. You got an alternative for me from Facebook?
I do. Last week you were complaining about Facebook's censorship and data mining.
Man. Give me something better.
We got a new one. We're a Kickstarter right now on Indiegogo trying to finalize it. It's called simplysocial.com. It's 100% free. There's no data collection, no ads, no pop-ups. It's totally encrypted, no data mining, no email required to even get an account.
I'm signing up right now.
All right. Simply we haven't got social. The sign-up yet. We're trying to finalize through the Kickstarter campaign on Indiegogo.
Well, let me kick in some money. You're writing it right now. That's fantastic. SimplySocial.com. Glad to give it a plug. Because, we need social networks that aren't spying on us. Is that too much to ask? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, I appreciate the plug. Are you involved in writing it?
I'm not in the writing. I'm in the admin side of everything else. But the problem we're having is we're trying to get the word out via Facebook and Twitter, and they're both blocking us. I sent out...
Oh, my God, those jerky jerks.
Yep. I went out and sent out to almost 100,000 people on Twitter, and not a single one got it.
Well, when this airs, you're going to talk to a million people. Maybe that'll help.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you. We love your show.
So how are they doing this? Who's doing this? Tell me a little more about it.
I've got a business partner and an uncle of mine that are doing this. We had to do it out of Switzerland for security and for privacy issues. We had to create a corporation out of Switzerland.
Wow.
And we're not doing it for the money like everybody else, because with no ads and no pop-ups,
there's no revenue
to monetize it.
But you have to, but you'll monetize it. You know, eventually the way to monetize it, just charge people $5.
Well, we may at some point. We're going to try selling T-shirts and other stuff to try and get some money, but that's the whole thing. It's end-to-end encryption. I mean, everything about it is everything that Facebook, Twitter is not.
I'm so glad you called. I will support it, and the minute I can sign up, I'll sign up, and I'll tell my friends.
Thank you so much, Leo.
Hey, congratulations. Good job.
Thanks.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go, and Mike is on the line from Maine, my favorite maniac. Hi, Mike.
How you doing, Leo?
I am great.
Calling, it's so great to talk.
How's the podcast? What is the airline pilot guy?
Airline pilot guy I work with sometimes, and the airplane geeks I'm contributor at large for, and we're just planning our trip to the Farnborough Air Show in the United Kingdom sometime.
Oh, how fun. What kind of air show is that?
Oh, that is like the big commercial air show. That's where airlines start buying their aircraft.
Oh, wow.
And the aircraft manufacturers, Boeing and Airbus.
We ain't talking World War I biplanes here. This is...
Well, they bring in some of those, too, for the public days. And, you know, last time I was there, it's every 2 years. It alternates Paris and the U.K. They had a P-40 Warhawk and a P-51, but I also got to see an F-35 in hover.
Wow.
Just amazing.
I have heard of the Paris Air Show. So this is that, but it's in England this year.
Right.
Got it.
Farnborough, England, 1 year, and then the following year it's in Paris, and then the next year it's in Farnborough. It's pretty much the same air show.
And airlines go there to look at the new Dreamliner or whatever, so they can...
Exactly.
Wow. How fun. Exactly. Do you get to see some of the big commercial aircraft, too, or is that...
The last time I got a tour of an A380 that was completely empty, nobody inside, nothing inside, stripped down.
No seats? Because the airline gets to configure it, right? So
right.
That thing must have felt cavernous.
It's bigger than our houses put together.
Yeah.
Unreal.
Yeah. I've flown the A380. It's such a big airplane, they have to have two stories to load it. At SFO, there's only one gate. People can go in the downstairs gate or the upstairs gate. It's wild.
It's wonderful. And you want to ask Johnny Jett if he's going, because he and I should get together if he is.
I will ask him, and I'll let him know the maniac Mike is there, and he'll look for you. So what can I do for you today?
Well, there's two things. First of all, a couple of weeks ago, you had a call about how on Google Image, there's no longer the search by image button or view image button.
Yeah.
And there's a solution for that. There's a new Firefox and Chrome add-on.
Of course there is.
View Image. It's called View Image, and it brings it back to both. So
it was so Google got sued by Getty Images, a big stock image company. You know, Getty buys pictures from almost every pro. And many amateurs, too, and they sell those stock images to people who want to use them in newsletters, websites, television ads, and so forth. It's a good business. Getty's the biggest. They've been around for many, many years. And they sued Google, saying, you know, your image search is killing us, because instead of buying images from us, people do image search. They find it's not that they're not using Getty Images. They find the Getty Images. They download them and use them. Now, I don't know if that's really true, because Getty puts a watermark on those images. It says Getty Images unless you buy it. So, but they won, and Google apparently gave them some undisclosed sum, maybe agreed to change some of the things they do, but the most visible difference was they removed the View Image button from the Google image search.
Yeah, and that really that was very difficult for me for some of the things that I do. I couldn't search by image to find a larger version of it, or I couldn't view the image. And now with this add-on, it's back, so I thought that might help Dickie DiBartolo's friend who had called in a few weeks ago.
Now, I am sure that you do not use copyrighted images.
Absolutely not. I truly don't. Yeah. But sometimes you do need an image, and if you see it and it's not copyrighted, how else can you find it?
Right. And there's also legitimate uses. For instance, on my TripIt, TripIt is a website where you have all of your future travel. I like to put an image of the place I'm going, and so I'll do a Google image search and just download an image. It's just for my personal use. It's not a violation of copyright in that case. I'm not publishing it. And I do that for other things, too. Sometimes when I'm writing a computer program and I want an image of a flying saucer, I'll look for people's images of flying saucers. You can still right-click, right, and save image.
Yes.
How does view image differ? Did that make it a higher quality or something like that?
It makes it a little – it brings it up to the natural size.
Ah.
And you can see whether it's the size that you want. And when you search by image, you can find the actual size that you might need to use.
As right.
Shrinking it up or expanding.
So they just made it a little harder to do, but there's right. still ways to do it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, please do respect photographers. You know, I talk to photographers a lot, and for years I've done this, and they're always upset that, you know, we want to share our photography. We'd love to share our photography with people, but we don't want them to steal our photographs. Is there any way to prevent it? And I always say, you know, if you're putting it on the internet, there's no way really to prevent it. You just have to acknowledge people are going to do that and encourage people to buy it, to support photographers, to support people who make their livelihood doing this.
I respect people like
Marquardt,
who works incredibly hard and does incredible work, and why would I want to steal from him?
Right.
That's not fair.
And I want to encourage people like him to post their images so that we can enjoy them. And he does. He does. To his credit, he does. My friend Scott Bourne, who is a wonderful bird photographer, often posts images on Facebook and Instagram of his amazing – he's famous for his eagle photography. And his sense is, and I think it's accurate, that that's great PR for him. People see his images. They're not going to use an Instagram shot in their newsletter or their magazine. They're going to want the full quality. So then they contact him and they buy the image. And I think that that's probably the best way to look at it. There's going to be some loss. You know, some people are going to steal your images, but in general, the publicity you gain is better. And it's nice to share your great photographs with the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that's not why I called.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. But thank you for that tip. Okay.
I just got a wonderful Windows tablet. It's a Lynx 1010B.
I'm not familiar with this. L-Y-N-X?
L-I-N-X.
L-I-N-X 1010B. All right.
Very inexpensive. Hard to find now. I don't know if they're manufactured, but when I got it, they were only about $100.
Oh.
Built-in keyboard. It came with a wonderful case, and it only has 32 gigs of memory, but it does have a micro SD card that can go up to at least came with 32 gigabyte micro SD card, but it goes up to at least 128 gigabytes.
So the reason these exist is because Microsoft doesn't charge for Windows if the screen is small enough. And so there's a lot of 7-inch, 8-inch tablets that are cheaper because they don't have to pay the Windows tax, frankly. And well, Microsoft figures, well, that's all right. Generally, they'll have only a gig or two of RAM, which limits its speed and performance. They'll have a slower processor. The real big issue, and I wonder if you're experiencing this, is if they don't have enough storage, they often cannot be upgraded. Have you had any trouble with Windows Update?
Not yet, and that's why I'm calling. Everything is updated. I have the latest version of Windows 10 on it, and what I've been very careful to do is I'm using portable apps as much as I can.
Yeah. The less you install, the better, because you're going to need a certain amount of slack space, free space, to upgrade.
Right. And I only have installed on the actual storage within the unit the two gigabytes. I'm sorry. Yes.
32 gigabytes.
Gigabytes is Firefox, Chrome, Audacity, because this particular unit comes with two USB ports, which is wonderful. Skype and Dropbox. Everything else is ported.
Yeah.
I guess I was calling to see if there is anything else I can do or I should do so that I can continue to update it.
Well, you know, I think having the SD card is good because that means your data, most of the things that use up space can be stored on an SD card. Microsoft themselves, I think they sell 32 gig devices. So I think you're okay. It's really the 8 gigabyte devices with 8 gigabytes of disk storage that are just not upgradable. And I don't think I think people should be aware of that and not buy those. 32, I don't think you're ever going to run into trouble. I can't tell you, you know, the spring creators update is coming out right now. And I can't tell you how much free space you need to install that. How much free space do you have?
I haven't actually looked recently, and I can always remove Firefox and Chrome. And really,
I'm going to guess if you have 8 gigs free, you're golden, and you probably do.
That.
Yeah, you probably do. It's when you have a total of 8 gigs, and Windows takes 6 of them that you're in trouble. That's when you, that's, but those are the people who are never going to be able to upgrade, and that you should be cautious about. I see a number of 32 gigabyte storage Windows devices. I'm pretty sure those would be upgradable. Try to keep, and you know, we'll have more information as this update rolls out, but I would guess if you have 8 gigs free, you're guaranteed to be able to upgrade. Hey, thanks for the call. It's great to talk to you, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Yeah, I think you'll be all right. Let me know, though, because that...
I'm Micah, though. I'm not Chris.
Oh, Mike. I'm sorry. Mike, thank you. I'm sorry, Micah. I bet you're all right, but you're Tuesday, as we're talking, not as we're recording, but Tuesday as we're talking, you're going to get the updates going to start going out. So I don't think you're going to have an issue with it. I really
great.
Don't.
That's really good. This, you know, this is a poor man's way to...
Oh, it's a great little tablet. Yeah, there's somebody in the chat room said, oh, I've had... Lawn Dog says, I've had this for 2 years. I love it.
Yeah. I'd love to be able to afford an iPad, but I just can't afford it. And this was under $100.
Right.
You know, so
Lawn Dog says that his 32-gig Enigmatic tablet stopped getting updates after 1607. So look at your Windows version, Micah, and see... that could be... that's cause for concern. He says he doesn't think he's getting updates anymore. That may mean you're not going to get the big updates. You might just get the small updates. Frankly, I don't think the Spring Creators update or whatever Microsoft's calling 1803, I don't think it's going to be that big a difference. So it's probably, as long as you're getting the hot fixes. Lawn Dog, do you get the hot fixes? That's the real issue. So Lawn Dog is saying run WinVer and check which Windows version you have, because WINVER, because he says he hasn't had an update since July 2016. That's not good.
I just got an update just last week. I haven't turned it on.
As long as you're getting those updates.
Update last week. So.
Yeah, as long as you're getting those updates, I wouldn't worry. I really wouldn't. Thanks, Micah. I'm sorry I called you Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Has anybody gotten the new Microsoft never really gave it a name. We're calling it the Spring Creators Update. Came out, officially came out. Let's see, was it April? Was it the second patch Tuesday this month? So what was that? I don't remember. About a week ago, maybe a week and a half ago. But that's just when it started rolling out, and then people will get it. You won't. It may take months before you get it. It'll be offered to some, and they do staged rollouts. I don't anticipate problems with it, but let me know if you do, because we'd certainly like to talk about it. Back to the phones we go. Arnie, San Fernando Valley. Hello, Arnie. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi. Is this Leo Laporte, the tech guy?
No, it's Leo Laporte, a tech guy.
Okay. Well, this is Arnie B, the listener.
Now, don't say that. It sounds like I only got one. That's bad. I know I have at least two, Arnie.
There you go. Yeah, I know I got a simple question for you, but try and put up with my simple question.
I like simple questions. They make me look smart.
We get constant updates on my Windows 10 machine, and since the last update, Leo, I am not able to shut down my computer. You know, when you hit the Windows key and you go to shut down, it won't shut down.
Does it start to shut down and then kind of come back up?
No, it gets a black screen and that's it, and the computer will not go off.
Oh, that's terrible.
Unless I hold the button down for 10 seconds and the on-off button on the computer.
Please don't do that, because that is actually cutting the power to the computer.
Of course, that's the only way I can turn it off.
I know. At some point, that's going to cause problems on your hard drive.
Uh-huh.
So it's not ideal. I understand that, you know, from time to time that's necessary, but it should not be your regular thing. So this is not unusual, alas. This is a failure with Windows Update. It did something that's preventing shutdown. Most likely there's something. So the way you have to understand what shutdown means. What shutdown does is Windows, and any operating system does this, sends a signal to all the running programs. And even if you're not running a big program, you've closed all of the programs you're running, there are plenty of services and stuff running in the background, dozens probably. So Windows sends out a signal, all of them, saying, okay, I want to shut down. Please go into your shutdown routine. And a normal program will say, oh, if it has files open, it might say, and you'll see this You want to save these files before you shut down? Some programs will complain and say, and Windows Shutdown will say, oh, I can't shut down. This program is blocking it. Most of the time, you'll get an orderly shutdown and everything will kind of turn itself off and Windows will shut down. What's happening to you is one of the programs you have installed, and it could be from an update, it could be some service that's messed up, it could be some program that's messed up. When it gets the shutdown, tries to do something, and it's broken. And it's basically crashing the computer.
Oh.
So,
nice.
Yeah, yeah. And this is not at all unusual. Of course, you want to let it have enough time. So sometimes shutdowns get stalled because the program takes a long time to shut down all of its services. So there are, it can be stalled. Usually what Microsoft will do is pop up a little thing saying, well, the Windows indexing service or whatever is blocking shutdown. Do you want to shut it down or do you want to wait? And it'll let you wait. But this is not the case here. It sounds like, whatever correct. Whatever program is going, and the whole thing's just going, boom. So.
That sounds like the user.
Yeah. And I presume you've let it go for, 10 minutes or something just to make sure. Oh, right?
20 minutes, 30 minutes.
Yeah. So this is definitely a crash. The good news is it may mean if the system's crashing like that, it may mean that all disk access is stopped. And so unplugging it or pressing and holding the power button, which are the same thing, is harmless because the only reason it's harmful is if it's writing to the disk at the moment you cut power. Then you can mess your disk up. So what I guess what you maybe could do, there's a lot of things you could do to try and diagnose this. It's not going to be easy, but if you feel in a sleuthing mood, you could look at Task Manager and see what's running and even close tasks one by one before you shut down, hoping to figure out what task is causing the problem. If you can, in fact, figure it out, then you can repair that program or reinstall that program or attempt to figure out, what's broken and fix it. But that's going to take some sleuthing, and you can do it with Task Manager. There's also Process Explorer, which is Task Manager on steroids. That's a free program from Microsoft, from their sysinternals division. If you Google Microsoft Process Explorer, you can download it. That's a little more powerful. It'll give you an idea of what's running. Sometimes it's, believe it or not, fast startup that can be causing the problem. That's problematic on many, many machines, and it is a good idea to disable fast startup on any machine that's having trouble either starting up or even shutting down. And
where do you find fast startup to shut it down?
So it does what it says, which it speeds startup up, but it can cause problems. So let me tell you where you can find this. It has to do with, frankly, changing the way your computer shuts down so that it can start up faster. Does that make sense? So it does change the way you shut down. So if you right-click on the Start button and search for Power Options in your control panel, so you're just going to open the Power Options control panel. Well, that's the fast way to do it is hit Windows key, Power, and type Power.
I'm at Power and Sleep right now.
Yeah. And then choose what the power buttons can do, and then change settings that are currently unavailable. Thank you, Microsoft. And you'll see after you click that link, change settings that are currently unavailable. It's got a big little, that Windows shield next to it saying, don't go there. You'll see a checkbox that says, turn on fast startup. You can uncheck that. And that sometimes will fix this shutdown process. Because what it's doing in order to speed up startup is saving out stuff into before it finishes. And if that's broken, and the reason I mentioned this is Londog in our chat room said that's what was stopping. That's was happening to me, and that's what fixed it, disabling fast start.
Disabling fast startup. So yep. on power and sleep.
It's in power options. Yeah, and then change settings that are unavailable. I think that's under the change what the power buttons do. You'll see that on the left. Change what the power buttons do.
Gotcha.
They keep moving this around. So that's all that is a serving suggestion. Your mileage may vary.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'll check it out. Can I have 30 seconds more?
What else? What else, Arnie?
I just want to tell you something happened to me, and I fixed it. But anyway, for some reason or other, my Gmail stopped working. I couldn't receive any Gmails. I couldn't send any Gmails. Very frustrating on my iPhone 8. And no matter what I did, I looked at everything. I disabled. I removed my Gmail, reinstalled it, did it three times. Nothing happened. Long story short, I just couldn't get my Gmail to work, and I really needed it for my business that I'm in. And so I said, well, listen, if it's not working here, I'll go to my and I worked on it for 3 days. I went to my computer and went to my Gmail, and guess what? Wasn't working there either.
Oh.
But you know what I found out?
What?
On my computer, it said, guess what? You've used up all of your space, and you have to purchase.
You did run out of Gmail. Space. One never realizes Gmail uses disk storage, and Google sells it. Takes a lot of mail, but you know what? That's the whole idea of Gmail. You never delete your mail. So you would run out of space. Hey, thank you for that tip. That's something people can keep an eye out for. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts. For this show, we talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time. I had to cut you off, but I think that was the tip, right?
Okay, but the thing is, I didn't know this, Leo, that when you have Google Photos and Gmail, they are combined.
Right.
And the two of them, you only get 15 total. Gigabytes yep. of storage.
Yep.
So if you have tons of pictures and you use up all that Google storage, your Gmail shuts down also.
It's easy to do.
Combined.
Yep.
And so you have to purchase. I purchased 100 gigabytes of storage for so much a year, not very much. But now, as soon as I purchased it, it came back and it worked. But so, nowhere on my iPhone did it ever say you're out of space with Google. And I had to go to my computer. If I had never done that, I still wouldn't have my Gmail working.
See, that's a little annoying because it really should say, buy more storage. I can't download any more mail or something like that. I mean, that's really not the right way to handle that on their part. So
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
But, you know, on iCloud.
They're missing the boat, too, because they could make some money selling you more storage, and they're not asking.
You're absolutely right.
But God knows Apple asks you all the time.
Exactly. But, Leo, it did tell me that on my PC. It said that, but it did not on my iPhone for some reason.
Yeah.
But so for your listeners who, if that ever happens to me, you have a lot of Google Photos, and that uses up 15 gigs. You won't have Gmail working anymore unless you purchase more space or get rid of your photos.
Excellent tip, Arnie. I appreciate it. And not, by the way, okay. Not San Francisco, anyway. San Fernando. I apologize. I saw the S and the F and the O, and I blurted all together. And good luck on that reboot, because that actually is a very good tip. Thank you, Lawn Dog. That okay. fast startup is problematic for so many systems.
Well, I will try and figure this out and look for that fast start thing.
Yeah, power. Know? I'm going to power option. Power. I guess you're right. It says power and sleep settings now.
Yes. But
yeah.
That's what you were saying. When you go to power and sleep, it does not say.
No, you know what? I'm looking at it, and that's because it's not the simplified control panel you want. It's the power options control panel you want. The old school. So type power options. Okay. Maybe edit power plan? Is that going to help us? No, that's not it either. Here's what you do.
Gotcha.
So it is power options. It's not that power and sleep setting. So if you type power, you'll see edit power plan. That is one of the old style control panels. It's still not the right one. But up at the top of it, it shows how it got there from hardware and sound. And then it says power options. So you want to back up one control panel to power options. That's the control panel. It's the old control panel, not the new control panel. There's another thing that drives me crazy about Microsoft. They have two different control panels, and they have different things. But once you get the old power options control panel, you'll see choose what the power button does. Then you'll see change settings that are currently unavailable. Then you'll see.
I just hit control panel, and I obviously the new one is on. It starts.
I know. It drives me crazy.
Settings, system and security, network and internet.
Yeah, you know, you're not going to find it there. So you have to. You know, it's a shame that this doesn't work for the words power options, which it should.
Okay.
What you want is when you type in power, you'll see power and sleep settings, but below that,
yes,
you will see the second choice, which is, oh, no, I've screwed it up.
Power. On mine, it says apps, Windows PowerShell, and then PowerPoint. Okay.
What is going on here? Now my keyboard is giving me strange fits. Power, edit power plan. So maybe just edit power plan, because that brings up the old control panel, which is what you want.
Okay. I just did that. Yes. And it says turn off the display in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Up at the top there,
yes.
You can, in the edit plan settings window, there's an up arrow.
Yes.
Click that or hit Alt up arrow. Now you're in the power options, believe it or not. And you'll see on the left, choose what the power button does.
Okay, I just did that.
Now, change settings that are currently unavailable.
Okay.
Now, yeah. And now you'll see at the bottom, turn on fast startup. Mine's off on this machine.
No, mine is turned on. I have a check mark, turn on fast startup. It says recommended.
I know. Don't. Uncheck that.
Okay.
Uncheck that. Also, while you're there, uncheck hibernate.
Oh, hibernate is unchecked.
Okay, good. Save those changes.
I just did.
Now, okay, the moment of truth, the moment you've all been waiting for. Shut down, Arnie.
Okay, I am about to shut down.
You may have to go through one full cycle because it goes back to how you started up, but see if this fixes it.
I have just hit shut down, and guess what, Leo? I got a beautiful screen here on the computer. Nothing's happening.
Okay. You may have to go through one more cycle because you have to start up with fast startup turned off, then shut down. And it may not fix it. It may not fix it, but see if that reboot worked. You know, you don't have to do the power button trick. Wait a while before you do that. Just make sure there's no disk activity going.
I will try it, Leo.
Cross your fingers that when you boot up, and then just if you want, I would check to make sure turn on fast startup didn't turn itself back on, but shouldn't. When you boot up, now you should be able to shut down because you had to change the way you started in order for this to work.
Correct.
So you had to go through one full cycle before this would work.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'll give it a shot, Leo. I don't want to keep you from all your...
Yeah, I got to do a few more calls before we go here.
Gotcha.
Thank you, Arnie. Have a great one.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks a lot, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.